We have a special offer for first-time donors to Issues Etc. For any size gift during the months of January and February, we'll send you an autographed copy of Pastor Will Wheaton's new book, Thank, Praise, Serve, and Obey, Recover the Joys of Piety. Make your first-time contribution online at issuesetc.org or send your check to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234, and we'll send you an autographed copy of Thank, Praise, Serve, and Obey. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Three of the Gospels record this. Now, they do record it in slightly different ways. And ordinarily, we view this as kind of a turning point, perhaps, at least in the disciples' view of Jesus. What have they watched Jesus do? They've watched him heal the sick and make the blind see. They've watched him perform all kinds of miracles from virtually the beginning of his ministry. He's raised the dead. He's fed 5,000 people in one day with five loaves and two fish. So when it comes to the question of who is Jesus, maybe it's not surprising that, well, Peter confesses the Christ of God. What does he mean by that? And what elicits that confession from him? We're going to be talking about Luke's account of the confession of Peter. The church observes it on the 18th of January. Joining us to do so, Dr. Arthur Jess, professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology, director of Spanish-speaking pastoral formation at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Jess, welcome back.
Nice to be with you this evening.
So if we could begin by kind of comparing and contrasting the other accounts of this event, if in fact it's the same event, that are recorded by Mark and Matthew, how does Luke stack up there?
Well, it's the same event, but both Matthew and Mark, and I'm going to work off Matthew, they have a little bit of a different approach to it. I mean, for one, Luke does not name where it is. It's Matthew who tells us it's in the district of Caesarea Philippi. I believe Mark does as well, which is up near Mount Hermon, you know, in the northern part of Israel, really near the mouth of the Jordan River. I did a dig up in that area in Banias, which is where Caesarea Philippi is. In fact, we did the dig on the grounds of where the palace was for Herod Agrippa II, which is right there in Caesarea Philippi. So it's up near Mount Hermon, and so we have a location. There's a little different confession, at least in Matthew. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But perhaps the biggest difference is what comes afterwards. In Luke, you go immediately to Jesus foretelling his death and resurrection, whereas in Matthew, you have the saying of Jesus, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this from you. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock, you know, I will build my church. I will give you the keys of heaven," etc. And then he charges them not to tell anyone who he was, that he was the Christ. So, I mean, that whole interchange is not there in Luke. The other thing that's really different, and I think this will get us into the Lucan text, is that Luke follows his confession of St. Peter immediately after the feeding of the 5,000, whereas in both Matthew and Mark, there's almost two chapters of events that occurs between the feeding of the 5,000 and the confession of Peter. I think, I hope everybody understands that. There is a feeding of the 4,000 in Matthew and Mark, which Luke does not have. But I think that juxtaposition of the feeding of the 5,000 and the confession of Peter is very, very important to understanding what Luke is about. Now, there's more there, because chapter 9 in Luke is a critical, climactic chapter in the Galilean ministry. And it's a symphony of texts that weave together this incredible, you know, theme of the identity of Jesus and the order of the kingdom. Those would be the two themes, I would say, of which the confession of Peter that Jesus is the Christ of God, as it says in Luke, is one of the climaxes. But it is a rather magnificent chapter, and that confession is key to understanding really the end of the Galilean ministry in Luke.
Is Luke foreshadowing it a little bit by telling us briefly there at the beginning, near the beginning of chapter 9, that Herod is kind of thinking through who is this Jesus, and he mistakes him for John the Baptist?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, if you go with the first six verses, you have the sending of the 12. Now, that seems to be, in a sense, disconnected. But if you know the kind of what Luke has been doing all the way back to the sermon in Nazareth in chapter 4, he is making it very clear that Jesus' identity is a prophet, like the prophets of the Old Testament, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, like John the Baptist, but he is the greatest prophet, the final prophet, the eschatological prophet, which means the end time prophet, and that there is actually a prophetic pattern that Jesus is fulfilling, and what he does, Luke does in 9:1-6, is he splices the 12, you know, apostles into that prophetic pattern. In other words, they follow the pattern of the prophets of the Old Testament, John the Baptist, and Jesus himself. And so the identity of Jesus as a prophet, which is what Herod sort of thinks he is sort of critical to understanding the identity of Jesus in Luke. And yet when he comes out and says, "You're the Christ of God," that really nails it down in terms of what kind of prophet it is. He is the anointed one. He is the Messiah. Here, finally, and this is the first time in Luke, a human being confesses Jesus as the Christ.
The way that Luke has the feeding of the 5,000 there, I note just kind of superficially that while they are sometimes called disciples, here it says on their return, that is, they came back from being sent out, the apostles told him all that he had done. And then he continues with the story of the feeding of the 5,000. What's changed there for the disciples?
Well, I mean, you're very observant. If you go back to verse 1, he calls together the 12. And that's very important. That's in many ways sort of that's the reconstituted Israel. And because they were sent out, when they come back at the very beginning of the feeding of the 5,000, he does call them apostles because they're the sent ones. But then you will notice that in verse 12, they're called the 12 again. So they're sort of now reconstituted Israel. And of course, the key to the feeding of the 5,000 is this, at least in Luke, this is the Moses miracle. We're in the desert. We're going to be multiplying food. This is what Moses did, and now the new Moses is doing it again, but in a way totally unlike the first Moses, in the sense that there are abundance. You know, there are 12 baskets full, one for each disciple. But then they're called disciples again, because they do sort of, you know, retreat into that role. And then at the very end, as I said, there's the 12 baskets. So the sort of the reconstitution of Israel through the feeding of the 5,000 and their sending out to preach the kingdom, to heal and be rejected. That's the prophetic pattern. Prophets are teachers, they're miracle workers, and for doing that, they are rejected. That is built into the very DNA of this chapter and the confession of Peter as to the identity of Jesus. And I think that what Luke is doing in conflating, you know, that material and bringing the feeding of the 5,000 and the confession of Peter together is that this is the new Moses. That's what Peter finally sort of figures out. And he figures it out by seeing this incredible miracle in the wilderness. And he realizes that Deuteronomy 18:15, that a prophet like unto Moses, that prophecy of Moses, a prophet like unto him is coming, you know, who's greater than him. Listen to him. That's the language of the Transfiguration, when the Father says, listen to him. So, I mean, all these things are tied together. There's this incredible kind of Moses, what we would call typology, which simply means that Jesus now is the fulfillment of who Moses was in the Old Testament, and he is now the Messiah, the Christ.
Is that saying Jesus has fulfilled the prophetic role? Is there more to it to drive home the point that here is Christ fulfilling Moses? Is there more to it than merely here's a guy who's more than a prophet, even the greatest prophet?
Well, it is in this sense. I mean, and you can see that being a prophet, in, at least in Luke, is a positive title. I mean, all the way through, they say he's a prophet, and Jesus affirms that. A prophet is not without honor in his own home country. The significance of it is that now the teaching that Jesus does is the Word made flesh. Okay, this is, it's like when he picks up the scriptures in the synagogue in Nazareth. Here's the author of scriptures reading his own book, and Luke has a statement there. He stood up for the purpose of reading. That's the whole reason he comes to the synagogue to read, because this is his book, and he says today this is fulfilled in your ears. So this is his book. These are his words. And his miracles simply testify not only to who he is, but that he is now the creator who has come to the creation to release it from its brokenness, its fallenness, once and for all. You know, and he, that is the great way Jesus preaches the gospel, at least in the Galilean ministry in Luke, is that he has come to release the captives, to forgive, you know, to heal, to cast out demons, to raise the dead. Everybody who is in bondage to those four things, and these are the four things in Luke, sickness, demons, sin, and death, Jesus is there to release them. That's why he performs miracles. And for doing that, you know, in his own hometown, they try to kill him. You know, the Pharisees plot against him. And of course, you know, you can see here in this magnificent chapter where the identity of Jesus comes out, immediately tied to that. There's nothing in between. You go immediately to the passion prediction that it is necessary that the Son of Man suffer many things, be rejected from the elders, chief priests, and scribes, be killed, and on the third day be raised. So that rejection is sort of the ultimate rejection, because it's the rejection of the Son of God. It's the rejection on the cross, the ultimate place of shame and suffering. And this is the culmination of, in a sense, the entire prophetic tradition going all the way back to Moses. And so Jesus does fulfill this. Now, for my money, this is continued in the 12. It's continued in Acts. And it's continued in the church, because I always say that the pastoral office is a continuation of this prophetic pattern. This is why it matters in many ways, Todd, that what do we do as pastors? We preach, you know, and it's a performative word. It creates reality. People's sins are forgiven. You know, Christ is present in the waters of holy baptism. He is present on the altar when we speak those words. And I claim that the miracles today, if you use my definition of miracles, that miracles testify to the presence of the Creator in his creation, making all things new. The miracles of today are the sacraments. Baptism is the presence of the Creator in water by word and spirit, bringing people from death to life, from darkness into light. The sacrament of the altar is the same thing. And those who are faithful to that, And I think there are many who are pastors can testify that to that today. We just heard a brilliant lecture at our symposium by Peter Scare on how there will be suffering and persecution in the church today for being faithful to what it is that we're called to do. Those who are faithful to word and sacrament, to preaching and performing these miracles of baptism and the Lord's Supper, they will suffer for that. They will suffer by being faithful to that prophetic pattern. And that is really, in a sense, that's our liturgy. That's what the church does. It simply continues what happened in the Old Testament that was, in a sense, brought to fulfillment in the Old by John the Baptist, of course, who was rejected to the point of losing his head, and then brought to its final fulfillment in Jesus, and now continues in us.
One more question on the connection to the feeding of the 5,000. I'm trying to think about how Luke wants that connection made for us, the reader. This is feeding in the wilderness in a general sense, but it's also bread, which we can't deny in John's telling of the account. There's manna connection here.
Oh, right. Yeah,
Jesus
absolutely.
Is talking about manna,
absolutely.
But this isn't manna that just shows up in the with the morning dew. this is manna that is coming straight from the hand of a man, of Jesus Christ.
No, exactly. And it's, you know, the contrast is really quite great. I mean, the parallels are obvious. There's a whole lot of people. You're in a desert place. And that's what it says in verse 12. They're in a desert place. But when Moses fed the children of Israel, and as wonderful as manna was, it, you know, it was fairly plain, and it was only for the day. You only collected for the day. If you took too much, it would rot. There'd be maggots. You know, you took two portions on Friday for the Sabbath. But I mean, that was a specific thing, and anybody who did that, they regretted it. And yet now that the new Moses comes, Jesus, you know, it's not just bread, it's fish too. And you know, in the earliest catacombs, you'll see a fish, which is of course the name of Christ, and on it is a flagon, and on top of it is a bread. And that you know, what they're in a sense communing with is the new Moses, the Christ, the Messiah who comes, and when he comes, there's abundance. I mean, that language is so important. You know, they ate and they were satisfied. That's the same word. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. And there are, and I love it, 12 baskets, and a lot of the translations don't have this, of broken pieces. He takes the bread and he breaks it, and there are broken pieces. And they're reclining, you know, they're reclining, and that's only at a festive meal. So this now has the character of a meal of the new era of salvation. You know, it's not the Eucharist, but it's Eucharistic. It's pointing to that. It's pointing to the end time feast because of the presence of Jesus. I mean, I did my whole doctoral thesis on table fellowship in Luke, and it's about, you know, the fact that he comes eating and drinking, teaching. You know, those are the teaching and eating and drinking, and he is present. He is present in, you know, in the flesh, you know, on the mountain, at the table, or he's present in with and under bread and wine. You know, it's a remarkable example of the Creator doing what he was created to do, and that is to nurture and feed his people. And even the constellation of words, taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looking into heaven, he blessed them and broke them and gave them to his disciples. And, you know, and you want to finish it, you know, with the words of institution, but to distribute to the crowd. But that's the table fellowship language. And that's what Jesus uses at the Last Supper. That's what he uses at Emmaus. I mean, it's all tightly wound up in Luke's gospel. I mean, he starts the passion with a meal. He ends the 3 days with the resurrection with a meal. Luke is making a statement about how God is present with us in meals. And that's how Peter knew that he was the Christ, because this was what the Old Testament promised when it had the feeding of the 5,000 with Moses. This someone greater than Moses would come, and here he was.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. We're talking about Luke's account of the confession of Peter. So having fed the crowds, Jesus next has a question about the crowds. Who do the crowds say I am? We'll take that up right after this. We have a special offer for first-time donors to Issues Etc. For any size gift during the months of January and February, we'll send you an autographed copy of Pastor Will Wheaton's new book, Thank, Praise, Serve, and Obey, Recover the Joys of Piety. Make your first-time contribution online at issuesetc.org or send your check to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234, and we'll send you an autographed copy of Thank, Praise, Serve, and Obey.
O Lord, hear my prayer.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Hey, Todd, What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Luke's account of the Confession of St. Peter. The church observes it on the 18th of January. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. Dr. Just, we have then, after the crowds have, we assume here, have been dismissed at some point afterwards, he is alone praying, and then the disciples arrive, and he asks this question. I'm assuming he's talking about the very crowds. In Luke's telling of this, the very crowds that he has just fed, who do the crowds say that I am? What's in this question?
Yeah, it's a remarkable question in the sense that it reflects what is obviously the oral tradition. You mentioned earlier about Herod's questions of the identity of Jesus. And there's a whole Herod, you know, theme in Luke's gospel. I mean, Herod is a very prominent person. And you can see that here he wishes to see Jesus after asking the question. I mean, and you can see he's troubled. He's hearing things. And he wants to know, is this John the Baptist risen from the dead? Has Elijah risen? A prophet, one of the prophets of old, has he arisen? Notice those are all prophetic categories. John's the great prophet. Elijah, I mean, there's nobody besides Moses who is greater than Elijah. And a prophet of one of the old ones. I mean, he's speaking of probably people like Isaiah or Jeremiah. He says then, John, I beheaded. First time in Luke, we know that John is dead. Who is this concerning whom I'm hearing these things? And he's wishing to seek him. Well, we see Herod wishing to seek Jesus in chapter 13. You know, when Pharisees come and warn Jesus, Herod wishes to kill you. And then, of course, Luke has, of all the evangelists, four trials of Jesus, more trials than anyone else. He goes first to the Jewish establishment, then he goes to Pilate, then he goes to Herod. And it says that Herod was for a long time wishing to see him. So, I mean, what you can tell from that is that there was, within the society, within the culture, within the religious establishment, within kind of the secular government, a wondering of who Jesus is. And I think that's why the feeding of the 5,000 is so enlightening for Peter. He finally sees who it is when he sees that. So when Jesus now turns to them, he's alone praying, and here notice it's now his disciples are with him. They've turned kind of into that lower status. They're learners, they're catechumens, You know, they're seminarians on their way to the cross with Jesus. And he asked them, the disciples, you know, who do the crowd say to me to be? Now you can see, there it is. You know, there is a tremendous amount of questioning within the world of Jesus as to who he is. And Jesus knows it too. John the Baptist, others Elijah, you know, because this is what how they answer him. And others, a prophet, a certain one from of old. In the Greek language, it's exactly the same language as what Herod was asking. So, I mean, this is a critical question. Jesus is finally, in a sense, putting it to them. And, of course, it's Peter as the leader of the 12 who really answers on behalf of the 12.
His answer is the Christ of God, and we should probably say maybe better translated the anointed of God, just for some clarity there, because it sounds a little stilted in English. What does that answer mean?
That answer is, in a way, what everybody's been waiting for. They've been waiting for the one anointed by God to fulfill the plan of offering up himself as a sacrifice for the world's sins. Now, not everybody would have put it in that way, but I mean, the entire sacrificial system of the Old Testament, of the temple, was looking forward to this final sacrifice of God for the totality of what happened because of the fall of our first parents in the garden. And the Christ is the one who is anointed. I mean, like kings are anointed. But you can see this in the baptism of Jesus. And Luke makes this very clear in the way in which he has this incredibly strong theme of Jesus' destiny in Jerusalem. And that the plan of the Trinity that is, in a sense, publicly proclaimed at Jesus' baptism now is set in motion when he is baptized in the River Jordan. And that's it, where he is anointed by the Holy Spirit, publicly now Messiah, Christ, the one who is designated to fulfill the messianic program. And I mentioned that before. He's going to teach who he is. And his teaching has power to do what it says. Those are his miracles, releasing people from their bondage, healing sick, casting out demons, raising the dead, forgiving sins. And he's going to suffer because of that, which is, of course, really, in a sense, the second part of Peter's confession. So, I mean, this is what everybody expected. And you can see Luke kind of affirms this in Peter's sermon in chapter 10 of the book of Acts, where it says, you know, he was anointed by the Holy Spirit, you know, and Peter explicitly puts that in the context of the whole program, plan of God. That is what the anointed one has come to do. So this is in many ways the great title, as we saw with Matthew. It's, you know, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. In some ways, it's even more explicit. And there's lots of thoughts about why Luke doesn't have that, but he does have a strong confession of Jesus as the Son of God, especially through the demons. They know that he is the Son of God. They know he is the Christ. Luke here just has the very simple, the Christ of God, which is really all you need.
I think it's Matthew's account that says, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. We get this little exposition on where this confession came from. But Luke does not include that. And I'm wondering why, since it seems to kind of just go so, in our kind of way we remember this account, it seems to go so perfectly with, he just made this confession of faith, and Jesus says, my Father in heaven has revealed this to you.
Yes, you know, it is a bit of a curious thing. But I think it, within the Lucan gospel, and you know, I think this is fair to say, all the gospels highlight Peter as first among equals. And in many ways, because of Acts and the 12 chapters that are devoted to Peter at the beginning of Acts, I mean, Luke Acts has more about Peter than any of the other gospels. But this is where in a sense, the keys are given to Peter, you know, where he is going to bind and loose on earth. And Luke, in a sense, places that in the context of the Lord's Supper. And it's really quite poignant where he does that. It's right after the words of institution. And I don't know if that's the reason he doesn't put this here, but he does have a similar sort of thing there. And then immediately following that, in the these are the final teachings of Jesus before he's arrested. I call it like his final pastoral theology to his disciples. And I put it in the context of the last will and testament of Jesus, you know, and it is, it's that what scholars call the testamentary tradition. Here's Jesus, the testator, giving to his disciples, the testates, you know, their future, you know, telling them what's going to happen to them. And one of the things is that they are going to be given the keys. You know, he does it in the context of eating and drinking at his table in his kingdom. And it's also there in those dialogues that he says, and you, Peter, you know, you're going to strengthen your brothers when you turn. You know, so in a sense, what he's doing here in Matthew 16, he does in the context of the Lord's Supper a little later on. And I think that, you know, ties this even closer to the kind of the life of the church that is always Eucharistic. And I, you know, you, what you said to start with, that, you know, this has been revealed to you, not by flesh and blood, but my Father. That is an important statement. And I don't know that there's an equivalent of that in Luke, but it is amazing. And again, Luke's just got a different agenda. I think what he wants to do, and you can see this in both Matthew and Mark, Luke wants to tie together the identity of Jesus and his work, you know, namely his passion and resurrection. And, you know, Jesus is going to rebuke in Luke, just like he does in the other Gospels, you know, you don't tell anyone about this. But it's not it's not just simply that he's the Messiah, but it's the whole thing. It's that he's the Messiah and what the Messiah must do. That is, in a sense, the scandal, that he must be crucified. And it's quite extraordinary. Of course, Luke also doesn't have the rebuke of Peter, you know, where Peter rebukes, you know, Jesus, and then Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." None of that's in there, you know. And again, I think to a certain extent, that's because Peter is so prominent. Luke gives you don't want to say necessarily a more positive view of Peter, because he does have some things like the denial of Peter and other things that are very negative, but he doesn't have that either. So you can see Luke is keeping things very cleanly together for a purpose, and that is, as I said earlier, the identity of Jesus and his work, and that suffering comes first and then glory. That's a key. I mean, anybody who gets those two theologies mixed up, if you put the theology of glory before the theology of the cross, you're in trouble, and Luke makes that very, very clear.
We'll talk about that suffering first, then the glory after the break. But before we go to that break, Dr. Just, you are the director of Spanish-speaking pastoral formation at Concordia Theological Seminary. What is that?
Well, we are trying to train and form pastors who are bilingual throughout our synod, and we are looking for congregations to send us their men who are interested in continuing the work of the ministry in a bilingual context. We have a program that is what we call SMP, which is an online distance learning program. It's very reasonable for our Hispanic men, and it's a chance for us to really try to serve what is one of the largest demographics of our country now. Almost a third of our country is homes that speak both Spanish and English. We're doing international work too. I now have a call as a career missionary half-time, and we actually have this remarkable situation, which I don't know of anybody else who does, where we have students from this country and students from all around Latin and South America on the same kind of course website. We have, you know, different administrations, one in the Dominican Republic, one in here in the United States in Fort Wayne, but we have the same Moodle, so they're all studying together, which is a most remarkable community.
You'll find a link to the Spanish-speaking pastoral formation program at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, two things. First, Jesus strictly commands his disciples not to tell anyone who he is. They have the answer right, but he doesn't want anyone else to know right now. Why is that? And we'll talk about suffering, then glory.
Why does it feel like everyone's always angry on social media? What exactly is a podcast? Is digital technology helping or hurting your spiritual life? How can the church harness the power of the internet to reach the lost? If these questions hit home for you, you won't want to miss this month's issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine on digital technology and the church. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Do you need a home mortgage, car, or student loan in 2018? Check out Lutheran Federal Credit Union. During January, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Grace Place Lutheran Retreats. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor. And today, there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Luke's account of Peter's confession. Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest. After Peter has made this confession, it says, "And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one." But the charge comes in the form of his passion prediction.
Yes, it's a remarkable, puzzling, almost verse. And you know, the charge is actually, the word in the Greek is rebuke. And if you look at how that's used, I highlight this when I teach Luke, that Jesus rebukes the demons in Luke 4. He rebukes the fever of Peter's mother-in-law, and they're released. And rebuking the disciples, even though it's not a quite the equivalent, it's a sharp and very sort of stern command. And yeah, he doesn't want them to reveal not only who Jesus is, and if you look at, again, if you look at the Greek language, these are connected. There's no break here. There's no period. These are all connected. He rebukes them and he commands them to tell no one, saying, you know, and then the passion prediction, and that word, it is necessary, the must. You know, there's a Greek word, day, that is just so important there, the must of salvation. And the fact that the title there, the Son of Man, that's Jesus in his suffering, and at least in Luke, there's a number, there are four passion predictions. And then in Luke, there are three passion statements in Luke 24 after the resurrection. Luke has more passion language than anyone else. But the fact of the matter is, nobody understands who Jesus is and what he must do until after the resurrection. In fact, in the next passion predictions, it even says that they didn't understand it and God hid it from them so they wouldn't understand it. because of the I think it's because of the horror of the crucifixion and the shame and the just the humiliation of it all and the just the darkness of what that was going to be and the fact that how can this be the Christ, even though the Old Testament spoke of it, and Jesus even chastises them for not, you know, reading the Old Testament and believing it. But it is a puzzlement, you know. It is a secret. They can't let it be known, and they're not even God keeps them from understanding it. Like at Emmaus, he closes their eyes so they don't recognize Jesus on the road, and it's the relatives of Jesus. It's his uncle and cousin he's walking with. They don't recognize their relative, but God, you know, he wants us to see that it has to happen through means. It has to happen through the opening up of the scriptures. It has to happen through the opened eyes and the breaking of the bread. I mean, those are the great Lucan themes. And you can see he's setting it up right here, that this is where all of this, you know, is tied together. Because this is the way Jesus did it. This is how he unveils his identity as the Christ and yet hides it from them, which is one of the great ironies of the gospel.
And he doesn't tell them why he's going to have to suffer all these things. I mean, this is so factual. Just going to be rejected by the religious leaders. He will be killed. He will be, on the third day, he will rise after suffering many things. And he doesn't say, for the sins of the world, or I'm laying down my life that I may take it up again. None of those kind of explanations for the why of what's coming for him.
No, exactly. And I mean, the language here is so important, because the language of suffering, that's why it's called passion, because that is what he does. He suffers the sufferings that are the sufferings of God for the sins of the world. Rejection, that encapsulates everything that has happened to him for 2.5 years in Galilee. The religious establishment, that language there, presbyters, chief priests, and scribes, that's a description of who sits on the Jewish council called the Sanhedrin. And they are the leaders. They're the ones who make the decision. And they're the ones who, you know, decided that Jesus must die and then took him to Pilate. What's also interesting, Todd, and I always point this out to students, and it's just fascinating to me. It says he's going to be killed. Now, before the actual crucifixion, Jesus never says, nor does Luke, that Jesus is going to be crucified. So it's interesting. He's going to be killed, but they don't know it's going to be by crucifixion, or at least it's not said. And yet there is language of the cross, and the language of the cross, twice here and then in Luke 14, is in connection with the disciples. Now, I don't know that we always try, you know, put ourselves in their shoes. I mean, this must have been incomprehensible to them. Not only that Jesus is the Christ, not only that he's going to suffer, be rejected, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. But then immediately after that, Jesus says to all of them, and this isn't just the disciples, now he's telling everybody, you know, if you wish to come after me, you have to deny yourself and take up your cross daily and follow me. Now, that doesn't make sense. You only take up your cross once. You know, you take up your cross. They know what that means. You're going to drag it out to where you're going to be crucified. How can you do that daily? You know, and then all the reversal language, you know, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. See, this is what, you know, we call the consequences of discipleship. But it's intimately tied to the passion prediction, because the disciples are going to follow in the way of Jesus. They're going to follow in his sufferings. And so this whole section is incomprehensible. And then he talks at the end, you know, how there's some of you who will taste, you know, who will not taste death before you see the kingdom of God, which I think is a reference to his cross. And yet right before that, he talks about shame. He talks about the end times. And now he's talking about the cross. And then he goes right into the transfiguration. They desperately need the transfiguration because it's so dark. You know, there's the prediction of death. There's the consequence of the discipleship, taking up the cross, this whole language of losing your life to save it. And then he does give them this extraordinary glimpse of glory, which is one of the themes of this section, suffering and then glory. You know, and it's an important sort of conclusion to the first 36 verses of chapter 9. I think that's all one unit. And it all fits together, and it's all part and parcel of Luke's teaching here that is centered in what we are going to celebrate tomorrow, and that is the confession of St. Peter.
Dr. Arthur Jest is professor of New Testament, chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology, and director of Spanish-speaking pastoral formation at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. You can purchase these resources by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or order online under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Jest, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and a blessed confession of St. Peter to you and all your listeners.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss a story in The Atlantic titled The New Age of Astrology with former astrologist Marcia Montenegro, and we'll continue our series on the Lutheran Confessions, talking with Pastor Paul McCain about the apology of the Augsburg Confession as it confesses the person and work of Christ. This is the confession that God has created in the heart of Peter and the other disciples. Christ has brought forth by revealing God to him, and it is the confession we, church, continue to make every day, taking up that cross. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.